Right. Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Werke, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you very much. Our first case this morning is the State of Minnesota versus Jared Mosdell. The appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument. The respondent will have 15 minutes. And then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. So Ms. Bartz, whenever you're ready, just identify yourself and you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Andrea Bartz. I'm an assistant state public defender and I represent the appellant Jared Mosdell. Mr. Mosdell was convicted of stalking in violation of Minnesota Statute 609.749, violating an order of protection and violating a domestic abuse no contact order for conduct that occurred for 5.5 weeks from April 6th until May 15th of 2018. Mr. Mosdell's conviction should be reversed because the state failed to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt. I'd like to start with the sufficiency of Mosdell's stalking conviction. Mr. Mosdell's stalking conviction should be reversed because the state failed to prove that he monitored KM, that she felt frightened, threatened, oppressed, persecuted, or intimidated, and the state failed to disprove his defense. Just noting, after Mosdell was convicted, the word stalking in the statute was changed to the word harass, but the portion that Mr. Mosdell was convicted of under Subdivision 2, Paren 2, remains the same. And that states in part, a person is guilty of stalking who follows, monitors, or pursues another. So here the state argued to the jury that Mosdell was guilty of stalking for monitoring KM, but the state failed to prove this. The state alleged that Mosdell engaged in 6 different types of conduct. So I'll just quick tick through those. There was running on the side of the highway when she drove by, posting publicly on Facebook, making entries in a notebook, bringing cinnamon rolls to his mother-in-law, trying to view a rental property, and then driving about a half of a mile behind her.
We're aware of, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
We're aware of all of the incidents that have been brought up. I'm concerned about the rental property and the inquiry there. Can you flesh out the testimony that surrounded that incident? The other ones, they may be damaging, but in the totality of the circumstances, I'm not sure that the state gets there. Of course, you're defending Mr. Mosdell, and I'm a little concerned about this calling up and finding a rental property in Casson. What exactly did he testify about, or the state's witness testify about in that regard?
Well, there was no evidence presented how Mosdell learned of the rental property. It was a small town, and there's no evidence that he knew KM had looked at the property. And KM wasn't present when he even went to speak to the landlord. And it's unclear when she went to look at the property and then when he went asking about it. So I don't think that amounts to monitoring. There's no proof he was surveilling her or watching her or anything like that. It could just be a coincidence. It doesn't mean he was systematically keeping track of her and keeping tabs on her.
Well, coincidence is one thing, but when you get into rural areas where at least two of your panel judges have resided in, a number of these coincidences end up being more than coincidental because you just keep popping up and it's very obvious and you're aware of behavior traits and so on.
Sure. Lived in a small town as well. But here the state didn't meet its burden to prove that any of these activities collectively or individually meet the definition of monitoring. I don't think the court should consider the Facebook post or the journal entries in its analysis for the sufficiency issue because the state agreed that those two things were protected. Yes?
I did have a question.
Well, you cut out there.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
On the running along the side of the highway, what concerned me was there was some suggestion in the evidence that he knew that was the time that when the alleged victim was, that's the time she always kind of picked up the kids. Now, I agree with you that, everyone has a right to run on the highway and you don't know when people are going to drive past you. But if he's doing that on a regular basis, knowing that's when she picks up the kids, And it based on the notebook in his house, he seemed to suggest he did know that was her. Why isn't that sort of harassment?
Well, again, I don't think the court should consider the notebook because that's constitutionally protected. Mazdell testified that he ran at all times of the day, that he started running. I think he ran over 50 miles in a month and lost like 50 pounds.
Good for him this time of year. My recollection of the record is that this was a one-time occurrence, and after that, she changed her route and the running never interfered again.
So she saw him running on Highway 250, which was a third of a mile from his house, on April 5th or 6th. They made eye contact. Then she said she saw him running a couple other times over a matter of weeks, wasn't sure of those dates, changed her route, no longer saw him. Every time she saw him, he was within a mile of his house. She drove by going 50 to 60 miles per hour. He was running in the opposite direction on the shoulder of the highway. So I don't think if he's running, she drives by and they happen to see each other, that's him systematically keeping track of her over this 5-week period and that he's keeping a close watch of her. Because after she changed her route, she never saw him again. And he does happen to live right there. So if she was frightened of it, she could have changed her route earlier. I'd like to turn to the cinnamon roll incident as well. I don't think that amounts to monitoring. On April 22nd, KM testified that she went to her mother's and noticed rolls that she recognized that he made. But according to her mother, Ms. Kramer, Mazdell brought the rolls earlier that day when no one else was there. And the state argues in its brief that Mazdell brought the rolls to Kramer to show KM that he was not going away, but that's not supported by the record. So bringing cinnamon rolls would not be monitoring KM, keeping close tabs on her.
Why is it not supported by the record? Did the OFP and the Danko prohibit indirect contact?
So I was just talking about the sufficiency of the stalking count, which goes to the definition of what he did to monitor her. But I can switch to why the rolls don't amount to indirect contact either for a violation of the OFP or the Danko. So he didn't give the rolls to Kramer. To KM, obviously gave the rolls to Kramer, the mother-in-law. He didn't ask her to give KM any message, and Kramer did not testify that she told KM the rolls were from Mazdell. And the OFP does not prohibit indirect contact, but even if it did, Mazdell didn't indirectly send the rolls to KM through Kramer. She just saw the rolls and thought, oh, those are the rolls that he makes. So that doesn't amount to contact in violation of the orders either. But if we could go back to why these don't amount to monitoring. So the driving, him driving a quarter mile, half mile behind KM after court one day, that was just a coincidence. It's a small town. They left court. He left, ran an errand to buy flower baskets, and then she left a little later, and they both happened to be just driving on the same road. He's about a quarter mile behind her. He calls law enforcement to tell them that's a coincidence. It's not him systematically watching her, and she didn't even know. There's no evidence that she knew he was behind her either. So for all these reasons, that's why the state failed to prove this element. The state also failed to prove that KM felt frightened, threatened, oppressed, persecuted, or intimidated, because KM did not testify that she had any of these feelings. Again, there was no evidence that she knew Mazdell had tried to look at this rental property, no evidence that KM knew Mazdell was driving behind her. So then any feeling she has must be based on the running, seeing rolls, a Facebook post, and some notebook entries. But she's the one who checked Facebook, and she's the one who went into his house without permission and read his notebook and then took pictures of two pages that mentioned her. So any feelings she felt weren't from his conduct. So then we're down to seeing him running and the rolls. And she didn't testify she had any of the feelings listed in the statute. She said she was nervous when she saw him running, surprised at first because she didn't realize it was him. And then because of the different things, she was more aware of her surroundings and more alert. But that doesn't meet any of the definitions in the statute. And the state didn't prove that she was frightened, threatened, oppressed, intimidated, or persecuted through her conduct either. Therefore, the state failed to prove this element. And then finally, the state failed to disprove Mazdal's defense. The jury was instructed in accordance with Subdivision 7 of the statute and CRIMJIG 13.66. So I'll just read the instruction briefly. The jig is that it was a defense to the charge if Mazdal's acts were performed to ensure compliance with the court order, authorized, required, or protected by the state or federal constitution or state or federal law, and that the burden was on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mazdal did not act in such a way with such authority. The state, however, didn't present any testimonial evidence to disprove Mazdal's defense. Defense counsel argued that the Facebook post, the journal entries, were protected by the First Amendment and the right to free speech, and that Mazdal bringing roles to Ms. Kramer was protected by his right to associate with others. And the state did not argue that these things were not protected by the Constitution. In its brief, the state does not argue that it met its burden. The state argues that it just didn't have to disprove Mazdal's defense. But this wasn't argued below in district court. The state has the burden because that's how the jury was instructed here. The district court gave the jury instruction, and those jury instructions become the law of the case. In addition, the pattern jury instructions is entitled Defense to Stalking Crime, and it states that the burden is on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act in such circumstances and with such authority. Even the comment to the instruction states that the committee believes it's on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the absence of the defense. So the state has the burden here because the jury was told that it did. The state relies on this court's opinion in AJB, but AJB was later overruled by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and AJB is also very different from this case. AJB was a juvenile case in which a court trial was held, and a jury instruction regarding Subdivision 7 was not given. So before the court trial, KJB moved to dismiss the stalking by mail and male harassment charges. The district court denied the motion and ruled that the statutes were constitutional. And then this court agreed with the district court. And this court reasoned that the state did not have to present additional evidence at the court trial regarding the statute's constitutionality because the district court had already decided that the statute at issue was constitutional. So the district court didn't have to make that determination again as a fact finder at the court trial. But that's not what happened here. This wasn't a court trial. Unlike in AJB, the jury was instructed that the state had to disprove Mazdal's defense. And again, the state did not argue that it didn't have this burden below. So because the state had a burden and didn't meet it, Mazdal's stalking conviction must be reversed. So I just want to quickly go to number two, which is his convictions for violating the OFP and the Danco must be reversed as well because none of his conduct amounts to contact in violation of those orders. So first, the state concedes there is no 500-foot restriction in either of the orders, saying that he must stay 500 feet from KM. And second, none of this conduct amounts to contact under the meaning of the word contact in the orders. Mazdal running on the side of the road wouldn't be contact because KM just testified that they made eye contact. There were no gestures. There was no communication, no coming together or touching, immediate proximity or communication like in State v. Phipps. Then the driving conduct, she did not know he was even behind her. So how is that contact? It's not. Rental property, she never testified that she knew he tried to look at that rental property. That's not contact either. And then I've covered how the roles weren't contact. No one testified that he was giving the roles to be given to KM. He never told the mother-in-law to give her any message. And then the notebook, that is definitely not contact. He wrote the notebook in his own home where he lived. She no longer lived there. He didn't send the notebook to her or even know he was going to go. She was going to go to his residence that day. The notebook wasn't addressed to her and she didn't have permission to read it. And the public Facebook post, that does not amount to contact because he did not use social media to contact her. It was a public post. He had no reason to think that she would read his Facebook post. And the state conceded it was a public post and it's closing on page 262.
Thank you,
so for all these reasons, thank you.
And you will have rebuttal. Ms. Hamill, we'll hear from you, please.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Melissa Hamill, and I'm Assistant Filmer County Attorney, and I represent respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. This morning, I'm asking that you uphold appellant's convictions for stalking, violating the OFP, and violating the Danko. I ask that the convictions be upheld because there was sufficient evidence for the jury to find proof beyond a reasonable doubt that appellant committed these crimes. When looking at this case, it's clear that in appellant's own words, he knows where his family is and he was not going to go away. I would ask that when you look at the evidence in this case, you consider two important things. First, you should consider the evidence in the context of the relationship between appellant and KSM. That's how the jury considered this evidence. Information came in, it was testified to by KSM that she was fearful of appellant, that she got an OFP and that OFP was immediately violated by him, which led to the Danko being issued. Now there was two restraining orders in place that prevented appellant from having contact with her. And he was on notice that that contact was unwanted and that she would be fearful or intimidated by such contact. You should also consider the evidence in this case as a whole. You look at the information that was presented at trial, you can see that there are multiple different incidents that occurred that led to the charging and conviction of the stalking. Looking at what the context of the relationship was and knowing that this contact and KM seeing appellant was unwanted, you see that he began to run on Highway 250 at the times that he knew that she was going to be driving on that road. Now, if he had done it once.
If I could just ask a question on that. On the subject of running, it's my understanding that he was like less than a half a mile from his own home. Is that right?
It is, Your Honor. And I think that that's important because if you look at the notebook, which kind of corroborates what KM was saying, you look at that and pretty much it seems like as soon as he saw her and she passed, then he would turn around and run back home. So I think that that's important because it shows that he wasn't going on these long runs and just happened to see her. He was stopping his runs and turning around and going back home pretty much immediately after he had seen her.
Okay. The fact of the matter, though, is he lost 50 pounds. So, you know, the legitimacy of the running tying in with his weight loss certainly shows he wasn't just running and doing it and going home and not achieving what, of course, he would promote as his objective, which would be weight loss.
Right, Your Honor. And those were some of the things that I think were considered and talked about in some of the testimony, and that he had many different other ways to run. It was that he chose a specific way to run. And after he saw her going that way the first time, and she was only driving in that location at a very limited time, that he continually then would run at that time. So she was repeatedly seeing him. And once she realized that this wasn't going to stop, then she did eventually have to change her route. But if he was really trying to avoid any contact with her, then, you know, he could have run at any different time. The testimony talked about how with his job, he worked from home and he had the ability to make his own schedule. So he really could have run at any time. And instead he chose these specific times when he knew that she was going to be driving on that road from picking up the kids from school.
I think ask you something that Ms. Hamill, if you don't mind. You know, we've talked quite a bit about the instances of the defendant's conduct, but the state also had the burden of proving that his estranged wife was frightened, threatened, or intimidated. And the record showed that she said she was uncomfortable at one occasion. She actually went into the house to look into his Facebook account on another occasion. What do you offer to us in support of your burden of demonstrating that threshold is met, that she actually felt frightened or intimidated?
Yes, Your Honor. One clarification, she didn't go into his house to look at the Facebook. That was something that she saw. It was a public post, so she saw it from somewhere else. But regardless of that, she did testify, and I believe it's around page 121 of the transcript, but she testified that she was always looking over her shoulder, that she was very much on alert. She was constantly checking her windows, locking her doors, because she never knew where he was going to show up, when she was going to see him. And so I think when you look at all of those behaviors and those things, she would not have done those things if she wasn't fearful of him or intimidated of him. And even changing her route of driving, if she really felt like that was just an innocent thing and that wasn't something that was worrisome to her, then she wouldn't have changed her route. She also did testify in terms of the running that, you know, she was constantly scanning the road when she was driving, worried that he was going to show up or be there, because she didn't know where he was going to show up or when he was going to be there.
All those, let me just talk about that a little bit. All those occasions where she saw, or on those occasions where she saw him running, I mean, she's always in her car, right?
Correct.
And he's always on foot, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
He may have lost 50 pounds, but I mean, he can't really do anything to her by running along the road. She might not want to see him. I get that part, but I don't understand how me driving in a car past or in the vicinity of an unarmed person out for a run is going to make me scared.
Well, I think the whole point of it is him showing that he's not going away, that he knows where she's at. You know, she said he made eye contact with her every time. We've talked a little bit about the Facebook post, and really what that did for her was show that, yes, he did see her. He did know that it was her. And that just corroborated her feelings that she already had, that he knew this was her. And him, when she had these restraining orders in place and he had originally blatantly violated those, and then to continually have him showing up where she was, I mean, yes, she was in a car and he was running, but he was within 4 to 5 feet of her, making eye contact with her every time, which is something she testified about. And I think that those are intimidating behaviors for someone who does have these restraining orders against another person. And that would make her fearful of where he was going to show up.
I understand the state's argument that sort of this amalgam of behavior is creepy and therefore violates the order. What do you think is your strongest incident that is a violation of the orders?
I think it's the running that he does, with him making that eye contact and being in that kind of immediate proximity to her. You know, that's really what she testified, is that he was making that eye contact with her every time. I think he was careful not to make those gestures, but definitely that eye contact is nonverbal communication, and it communicated something to her, and that's that he was there, he was showing his presence to her, and that was intimidating to her.
I just have to say this. I think anybody that's running would be foolhardy to not pay attention to your surroundings, which would include eye contact with people that are driving, especially if you're running on a rural road or the Fillmore County highways. I just have to offer that as a comment. That's not a question. But I don't know how you would address that. You don't expect someone to run down the road, jog down the road, and keep a blind eye to what's going on with your surroundings. I mean, that's why I think your argument is somewhat disjointed. If you have anything else to say on that topic, I'd be interested in hearing it.
I think you're right on that, but I think then that kind of comes back to the timing of when he was running. And, you know, if he was really trying to not violate those orders, then he could have changed his timing. I mean, even changing his timing by 15 minutes, he probably would not have seen her. But like we said, he had this open schedule where he could run at any time. And he was specifically choosing those times, putting himself in that situation where he would then be making that eye contact. And I think that's how it's different from just someone who's running in general. You know, briefly talking too about the cinnamon rolls, if we look at those incidents where he took those to her mother's house, he took those to her mother's house knowing that she was going to be there later in that same day. He didn't take them on a different day. He took them on the days that he knew that she was going to be there. And his testimony too was he was taking them for everyone at the brunch. So he was taking them knowing she was going to be there for everyone. He didn't take just one cinnamon roll and give to his mother-in-law. And as KSM testified to, as soon as she saw those, she immediately knew that those were the cinnamon rolls that he made. There was no doubt in her mind. So he didn't need to tell his mother-in-law that, tell them I made these, because they were something that was very unique and specific to him. So as soon as she saw those, she knew that those were something that he had made and brought to that location.
As well, right?
Yes, there was two incidents where he brought those. One was Mother's Day and one was not on Mother's Day. And briefly, just in terms of, disproving the defense as it relates to the stalking, I did make the argument in my brief, and I think that that's well briefed in terms of whether or not the state was required to disprove that. But even assuming that the state was required to disprove that defense, I think all the evidence was put on, and it's important to note that the jury was given that instruction. So when they considered the evidence, appellant did testify about doing certain things to stay within the bounds of an order. And those arguments were made that his conduct was not done to stay within the bounds of an order, because there were many different things he could have done and would have done differently if he was trying not to violate those orders. So even assuming the state was, required to disprove that defense as the jury was instructed, the jury had that crim jig. They had all that information. They had appellant's trial counsel's arguments regarding what they felt the evidence was to support that defense. And ultimately, they still found beyond a reasonable doubt that the appellant was guilty of these offenses. And if the court has no further questions, I would conclude just by asking that the appellant's convictions be affirmed in this matter.
Thank you, Ms. Hamill. Ms. Bartz?
Thank you.
Welcome.
First, KM and her mother, Ms. Kramer, only testified about one time that Mr. Mazdal brought rolls, and that was on April 22nd. the record does not support what the state repeatedly says in its brief and here today, that Mazdal gave the rolls because he was not going away. On page 193, he said he brought the rolls as a gesture to show Ms. Kramer they would always be family. So the rolls don't equal monitoring. How's he watching her through rolls? And they don't equal contact. There's no testimony that he knew she was going to be there later that day, or that he said, give these rolls to her, or send a message, anything like that. And Ms. Kramer never told her the rolls were made by Mazdal. The reasons for the Danco being issued, those are not the conduct. That's not the conduct that he's convicted of stalking for. So we can't look at that conduct to consider that she was afraid. We have to look at the conduct he's charged with for the stalking and whether that conduct caused her to feel fear or any of the feelings enumerated in the statute. That didn't happen here.
Let me ask you a question, if I might. Ms. Hamel, I asked Ms. Hamel whether what was the strongest single incident that the state had. Let me ask you, should we consider these things individually, or ought we to look at the pattern of conduct and determine based on multiple things considered together whether there's a violation of the order?
The state argued at trial it was collective, but the Facebook and the notebook, those are constitutionally protected. This court definitely shouldn't look at those. And they conceded at trial that those were just corroboration, but
The Facebook post, it seems like that is at the very least not definitive as to who he was referring to. He was saying that he saw a pretty girl while running, as I understand the Facebook post. Is that right?
That's true. I agree.
There's a reasonable doubt on that question as to whether he was even referring to the protected person. Maybe he saw a different pretty girl. I don't know. People write all kinds of stuff on Facebook.
Right. And the running that happened a handful of times in 5.5 weeks, and he was running in the opposite direction. She's going 50 to 60 miles per hour in a 60 miles per hour in a suburban down the highway. He's on foot. This happened just a handful of times, and she doesn't remember the days. So how is that him monitoring her systematically, keeping a close watch over her? She's driving in a car. So again, I don't see how this is monitoring, and it's not contact either, because eye contact is not the type of contact prohibited in these orders, or by the definition of contact. There's no gesture. There's no communication. There's nothing. And being uncomfortable is not enough. There's specific feelings enumerated in the statute. So if she was so afraid, why does she keep driving by?
Well, I mean, this Highway 250.
If she was so afraid, I check his Facebook page.
But I mean, this Highway 250 that he runs on, I mean, is that sort of the main drag that everybody has to use to go to here and there?
I'm not from the area, but there's a map, I believe, of one of the exhibits. And he's like the first house in a rural area. You know, it's probably blocks or chunks that are large. And so he's probably just running a route around his house. Anyway, there's nothing also in the record to support what the state said about him, like, turning around to follow her car. She's going 50, 60 miles an hour. And I don't think the court should consider the notebook, because again, he wrote so many different things in there. He wrote when he woke up, when he went to sleep, what he ate, how far he ran, that he went to Costco. And then he wrote her name. He wrote KM passed, or excuse me, Kathy passed on my right and saw suburban. But that doesn't mean he's following her, surveilling her when he wrote that down. So the state just didn't prove these elements beyond a reasonable doubt, collectively or individually. They don't amount to monitoring, and they don't amount to contact. And so we would ask that Mr. Mosdahl's conviction be reversed. Thank you.
I had one question, Ms. Bartz. Are you saying we should, if we agree with you, reverse this outright or reverse and remand for a new trial?
Reverse outright for insufficient evidence on all of the charges. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Hamel. Thank you, Ms. Bartz. The matter is submitted.
Thank you for setting this up, this WebEx. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.